Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. We all deal day to day with a lot of questions and probably a lot of fears around work, money, health, politics, relationships, traffic for that matter, right? And at some point, we're all going to deal with the final fears and the final questions, fear of death and questions about what it means and what, if anything, comes after. At his request, today's guest, Sarah Davidson, met every Friday for 2 years with 89-year-old Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, the iconic founder of the Jewish Renewal Movement, to discuss what he calls the December Project. I'm going to quote the rabbi. When you can feel in your cells that you're coming to the end of your tour of duty, what is the spiritual work of this time, and how do we prepare for the mystery? Davidson, who describes herself as having a seeker's heart and a skeptic's mind, feared death would be a complete annihilation, while Reb Zalman felt certain that something continues. He didn't want to convince her of anything, but to loosen her mind. Through their talks, he wanted to help her and other people not freak out about dying and enable them to have a more heightened and a grateful life until then. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Sarah Davidson is the best-selling author of 8 books, including Loose Change, Three Women of the 60s, Joan, 40 Years of Life, Loss, and Friendship with Joan Didion, and Leap, What Will We Do with the Rest of Our Lives? She's written more than 150 articles and essays in the New York Times Magazine, Newsweek, Harper's, The Atlantic, and Rolling Stone. And she was a successful television writer, creating 2 series and winning a Golden Globe nomination for her work in Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. Welcome again to Free Forum, Sarah Davidson.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here again.
Okay, first of all, I want to thank you for the interview that you did with me several weeks ago. I've gotten wonderful responses from listeners, and that was when, for those who missed it, I turned the tables and had Sarah interview me for an hour. And if you're interested, you can find that interview among the podcasts at my site, aworldthatjustmightwork.com or terrencemcnally.net. They're the same one, or at iTunes. So, as you well know, Sarah, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. And so I gave that brief bio and list of credits. But can you tell us in your own words a bit about your path to where you find yourself today, the work you're doing, and feel free to mention mentors and turning points and moments of decision, that sort of thing?
Well, I'm going to talk mostly about my spiritual life.
Very good.
That's what this book is grew out of. I started out as a reporter for a newspaper, and then I started writing freelance articles for magazines. And it was the 1960s, and my attitude was one of cynicism and a bit of making fun of my subjects, if I thought they were worthy of ridicule. And then I had a kind of shift in my life where I had been an agnostic. I was raised in Los Angeles in a Reform Jewish temple that was so stifling to me. I mean, the services were so boring. I couldn't wait for them to be over. Sunday school was a nightmare. I mean, I was teased for being tall and skinny and by the more popular kids, and it was like an ordeal every time I had to go to Sunday school and face that. And when I was confirmed, which was another year of torture, I resolved that I was not going back in any temple again. When I left home for college, I thought, I'm done with Judaism. But I was always somebody who I would say the best description of it is a seeker. I was always looking for answers to life's mysteries, to those deep questions that people have been asking since people existed. And I was always in search of some kind of experience and transformation and information. I had tremendous curiosity, which is why I became a reporter. I got to turn my excessive curiosity into a way to get paid. And as I said, at first I was a very kind of saucy, my attitude was, I wrote about communes, I wrote about rock groups, and there was always an edge in my writing. And then somebody gave me a book by Ram Dass called Be Here Now.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it, and I totally identified with him because he said he was a Jewish overachiever who never was happy, was always miserable, no matter how much he attained in the world, how much success he had, how much money he had. He was always wretched feeling inside. And I said, that's me, too. So that started me on a very different path.
Now, let me cut in for a second, because for those who know, I actually saw Ram Dass in one of his first presentations on his return to America in 1969 when he journeyed to India and come back with the information that became that book, Be Here Now. His path included a guru.
Yes.
And I have a feeling, A, because I sort of know, but B, also from that kind of seeker you're describing, that a guru wouldn't be the answer for you.
Well, I hoped I would get a guru in the early years.
You'd have been fine with that.
Yeah. Oh, please, somebody to tell me exactly what to do and what I, you know, and who would know me inside out better than I knew myself. And I thought it would be wonderful to have a guru, but I never succeeded in finding one. And I, as I said, I was a seeker. After reading Ram Dass, I tried Buddhist meditation, I tried yoga, I tried Sufi dancing, I did Tai Chi. I was looking for my guru, and it would have been Ram Dass, but he told me when I interviewed him, I'm not anybody's guru.
Damn.
Yes. So then after about 10 years of looking unsuccessfully, I had an experience where I realized not everybody gets a guru.
That's right, yeah.
And that not only that, I didn't feel I fit in any place. Like, I never felt, okay, I'm a Sufi, or okay, I'm a Buddhist. I would glean what I could use from various traditions but not fully immerse myself. And I thought that was a failure of mine. You know, they say on this spiritual path there's two ways to go. You can go wide or you can go deep. And deep is getting one guru or one tradition and going as deep as you can with that. And the wide path that I took was experiencing and exposing yourself to lots and lots of teachers. And you become what I call a spiritual mutt. You know,
a
little bit of all of it. And there was a moment that came when I totally embraced that and felt really that my own inner lights were the only thing I needed to take guidance from. There was a point where somebody invited me to take a nature tour of the Sinai Desert, and this was in the 70s when Israel controlled the Sinai Desert. They had just won it in the Six-Day War. And so I went. I'd never been to Israel. I had no interest in it because I had such a bad experience with Judaism being force-fed to me when I grew up. But I flew to Jerusalem to take this nature tour, and I suddenly saw this incredible diversity and richness of Jewish practice that I had not seen in West Los Angeles in the Muslim temple. And I started wondering, well, maybe I could find a place here. Maybe I could find a teacher here. Maybe this is my path. And as I began exploring Judaism, one name kept coming up, and it was Reb Zalman Schachter. And I was told that he was creating a new branch of Judaism for people like me who were living a secular life, who weren't Orthodox, who were hungry for meaning and spiritual fulfillment, but couldn't fit in with the traditional Jewish groups.
And remind us again, what year is this?
It was somewhere in the 1970s. I'd say 1974.
Okay, mid-70s. Very good.
And I heard he was speaking. I heard Reb Zalman was going to be speaking at a synagogue in Long Island, and I was in New York at the time. So I took a train out to this far-flung community, and he, after his presentation, he and I sat together for 10 or 20 minutes. Neither of us can remember anything we said, but something passed between us. There was just a sense of love, a sense of recognition that we could be friends, we could do something together. And over the years, I would call him occasionally. I was a reporter, and if I needed a quote about something related to his arena, I knew he would give me something colorful and sometimes outrageous. But we never really got to know each other. And then, flash forward, it's 2009, and I live in Boulder, Colorado, where he also lives. He was teaching at Naropa University, and he gave a talk for a new book of his at a bookstore. And I went to the store. It was crowded with people. I sat on the floor, and he started singing and talking, and he just created this field of joy and delight. And I was sitting there feeling it, and everyone else was feeling it. And afterwards, I went up to him and blurted, "Reb Zalman, I'm between books right now, and I know you're gathering your archives for a legacy project at the university here. If there's anything I can do to help you, let me know." I didn't expect to ever hear from him again. But the next morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, he called and said, "There is something I want to do with you. I want to talk to you about what I'm calling the December Project. I've been in your years, but you haven't been in mine, and nobody ever talked to me about what it's like when you reach that age and when you can feel that you're approaching death. What is that like, and what's it about, and how can we handle it? And how can that knowledge help us live all of our lives to the fullest and squeeze every drop of meaning out of it?" So I jumped at the chance to spend time with him, and we met every Friday for 2 years. And the book, The December Project, is the story of what we learned, how we changed, and how I personally came to an entirely different relationship with mortality.
Very good. And so what's interesting also is you're meeting Friday. What time of day? I'm just curious.
We met in the mornings.
In the morning, because for people who aren't aware, Shabbos happens for many Jews at sunset Friday. So for Reb Zalman, who I believe observed that Shabbos, this was one of the last things he did at the end of each week before going into Shabbos.
That's true. And, of course, I did not keep Shabbos.
Right.
That was the big difference between us. He is, it's interesting, a little bit about his...
Yeah, go ahead. That is one of my questions. As a matter of fact, that is my next question, is tell us a bit about his story.
Well, he was born in Poland and living in Vienna, Austria, when Hitler annexed Austria. And he said overnight there were swastikas hanging from the ceilings, and we had to wear armbands. And his father had a knowing to get out of there as soon as possible, and with much, much trouble at running at night and secrecy, they were able to get out. His father and his wife, his mother, and he and his sisters were able to get to Belgium, which at that time was one of the only countries that would accept Jews who didn't have a lot of money. And while he was in Belgium, he met members of a sect called the Lubavitchers.
You know what, Sarah, before you do that, I want you to tell one anecdote that you tell in the book about a boyhood friend when the Nazis come into power. Do you know the one I'm talking about?
Ooh, I do. He was going to a secular school half the day and to a religious school half the day. And at the secular school, there was a very poor boy who never had any food. And Zalman made a point of asking his mother to give him extra food. And he always shared his lunch with this boy whose name was Hans. And when the Nazis came to power, suddenly, Hans, who had come to school in rags, came in a crisp brown uniform. He was part of the Hitler Youth. And one day after school, he made Reb Zalman do push-ups and knee bends in front of a store that had a big sign in it that said, "Don't buy from a Jew," Jewish owner, that the Nazis had placed there. And Reb Zalman had just had his appendix out, so to do knee bends was excruciatingly painful. And then Hans, who he had shared his lunch with all those years, forced him and another friend who was Jewish down to the river, to the Danube, and they started cutting off their side locks. They called payas, the black, the Jewish boys would wear these black side locks. And Reb Zalman wanted to kill him, but he couldn't do anything because there was an SS man standing by the river playing with a Luger, watching what the boys were doing and approving of it. And he knew that if he struck back at Hans, that his family would suffer. So they had to take a beating and then crawled home. And that was when he said to his father, "Papa, the Nazis will kill us all. What shall we do?" And his father said, "I'm going to think of a way."
Okay, I just want people to get a sense of that because, you know, we're dealing with Reb Zalman in his late 80s, in this time of both challenge but also of enlightenment and so on. And I thought just to get a moment, if you will, an event of what it was like in his youth when that happened and before they fled. So you had taken us up to the point, Sarah Davidson. Let me tell people again, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Sarah Davidson about her new book, The December Project, An Extraordinary Rabbi and a Skeptical Seeker Take Aim at Our Greatest Mystery, in which she interviews Reb Zalman weekly for a couple of years and end up with this book on the meaning of life, death, dying, etc. So you're telling Reb Zalman's story, and his family manages to get to Belgium.
And then they managed to get on a ship. I mean, it's a long story, and you can read it in the book, but they managed to get to Marseille and get on a ship bound I think they landed in Puerto Rico, and from there they made their way to New York. And while he was in Belgium, he had met members of a sect called the Lubavitchers. You've probably seen them. They wear long black coats and black hats, and they go around in what they call a mitzvah mobile, where they try to get Jewish men to put on phylacteries. They're these black things they wrap around their arms and pray, and they give out candles to women, Jewish women, urging them to light Shabbos candles. And anyway, they are, and they have a leader called the Lubavitcher Rebbe.
Now, let me ask you this. In L.A., where we're broadcasting, Chabad's telethon is a fixture in the local culture, right, every year. What is the relationship of the Lubavitcher to Chabad?
It's the same thing.
Okay.
It's just different.
So it's those folks. It's those folks.
I'm glad you brought that up. The Lubavitcher Rebbe is head of Chabad.
Very good. That's C H A B A D, and they, as I say, they do good works, and they have a telethon every year, which I think is probably how some people can get a picture of what you're talking about.
Right. Well, it's not for those of us who are secular. It's not a very attractive picture. Sometimes they look standoffish, and you know they look like they're the Amish who are dressed as in costumes of the 17th century, but for Reb Zalman, these people had embodied a spirituality that he'd never been exposed to in his yeshiva, where he was forced to go as a child, where they did everything by rote as fast as they could. The Lubavitchers, the Chabad, was about singing and praying and dancing and yearning for closeness with God. It was mystical, and it was juicy, and he loved it. And when he landed in New York, he made his way to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, told him they had just arrived penniless, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe listened to him with such compassion and found a place for them to live. He found work for the parents, and he accepted the children into one of their yeshivas, the Lubavitcher yeshivas in Brooklyn. And for the next period of years, Reb Zalman studied as a Lubavitcher and was ordained a rabbi in Chabad, and he loved it. I mean, when he told me what their schedule was like, it started at 7 in the morning and didn't end till 9 at night and was all praying and praying and praying and praying. I said, it sounds really terrible to me. And he said, "I loved it. I felt there was nothing more wonderful going on in the world than this." So he becomes a rabbi. They arranged a marriage for him when he was 19 and the woman was 21. And the interesting thing is they got no instruction about sexuality or anatomy, and they were married and urged to create a lot of children.
Now, by the way, what you leave out in that sentence is because, let's face it, not all that many of us get instruction, but most of us have had some experience prior to marriage. But because of the rules, they hadn't. Is that correct?
Yes. The men were not allowed to touch a woman who was not in their family. They were not allowed to hear their voice because it might distract them from thoughts of God. They were not, the women had to cover their hair because it was too seductive if they had flowing hair. So
now this sounds very similar to what I think Americans more associate with Muslim culture. Very similar.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so he had never even been on anything like a date. He went to a matchmaker.
Right.
And he said when he went to the matchmaker was reading Torah, which was the sacred Jewish the first five books of the Bible, aloud to his wife while she darned his socks. He thought, this is the ideal. This is what I would like to have. A woman I could teach who would darn my socks.
Yep.
Well, they had five children, but what funny thing happened to Reb Zalman. He had this tremendous curiosity. He wanted to know what was outside the narrow confines of the Chabad community. And he started reading books that were forbidden. They were forbidden to read psychology or philosophy. They were forbidden to read books by rabbis who weren't in Chabad. But he wanted to know what they were saying. So he started this secretive reading. And then he was sent out on a mission to universities to talk to young Jews who had abandoned Judaism and were meditating and doing things from Eastern cultures. And he met lots of different people and was exposed to different ideas. And he came to the conclusion that to reach these young people, he couldn't do it by making Lubavitchers of them, by taking them back to a culture that flourished in Europe before the war. He had to renew Judaism for this time and place that would speak to their needs and desires for meaning. So he created this movement called Jewish Renewal, and it led to him being kicked out of Chabad. But today he has ordained more than 125 rabbis and cantors, and there are Jewish Renewal congregations everywhere. But more important, his teachings and his ideas that were so considered so far out and iconoclastic in the 70s when he was developing them are now part of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what's interesting in that evolution, let me say again, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally, and that other voice is Sarah Davidson. And we're talking about her book, The December Project, that emerges from 2 years of interviews with Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi, the founder, as she just said, of Jewish Renewal, is that he found a home with the Lubavitcher and Chabad. And then he outgrew that home.
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting that he tells you nothing felt better than that life, and yet there was a part of him that couldn't be satisfied even with that. I think it's such an interesting path he's on. So he goes out to, I'm guessing, recruit college students to the Lubavitcher and ends up in some ways being he ends up being recruited to the new mission in his life.
Well, he starts it. Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. And this was, of course, you have to place it in time. This was a time when there was what I call a great awakening happening all over America. At the start, you know, in 1966, when I took my first yoga class, it was something kooky. If you looked in the Manhattan phone book, there were only two or three listings for yoga. And, of course, today the listings are 4 and 5 pages long, totally mainstream. But it was a time when young people were, you know, the youth culture, part of it was a search for meaning outside of the traditional established churches and synagogues. So he was part of that huge shift from what he calls triumphalism, which is one way is the only way and the best way, to universalism, which is God wears many different faces to talk to different people, and it all is about the same source. It all comes from the same source. So that shift which now we understand very clearly was revolutionary, and he was one of the pioneers.
Yeah, very good. That's the voice of Sarah Davidson. We're talking about the December Project. By the way, I want to mention, Sarah, that you are going to make a couple of appearances in L.A. to talk about this book in the next few weeks. Monday, April 7th, you'll be at USC at 7 p.m. April 7th, Wednesday, April 9th at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills at 7:30, and you can get information about your appearances in L.A. in early April at your website, sarahdavidson.com, no H in Sarah. So he starts Jewish Renewal in the 70s, and as you say, it flourishes. My sense is that that as a new strain, it actually probably kept a lot of people in touch with the Jewishness that they might have lost otherwise. What is the life in a Jewish renewal
group?
I didn't know what you would call it, a congregation group, as different from others?
Well, at the beginning, when he started them, the difference, first of all, he had men and women praying together, and in the Orthodox community, women are separated. He had women being counted in the minyan, which is the 13 people necessary to have us to do certain prayers. So it was revolutionary in that way, but it was all about experience. It was all about feeling. It was about singing. It was about dancing. It was about listening to stories and feeling how they resonate inside you. It was about having a direct experience of God, which is what the mystic is always looking for. Rather than reading about somebody else's experience with God, you want to create it in yourself. And that was the revolutionary part of his message. Now, the interesting thing is today you could go to many Jewish congregations and many Christian and other faiths and experience some of that same inclusion of experience. I mean, when I went to services as a child, it was like you were an audience. The rabbi preached and the cantor sang. Now, if I go to a Jewish renewal service, everybody sings, whether you know the words or not. They flash them on a screen overhead. If you can't read it or something, you just scat along.
Has some of these more direct experiential relationship with God sorts of experiences filtered into other forms of Judaism, or is it only taken hold in renewal?
No. Absolutely. I'm
yeah.
going to speak at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills, which is headed by Rabbi Laura Geller, and she is using meditation. They have body movement, and she does a lot of experiential things.
Without calling her place a Jewish renewal group?
That's true.
Okay, that's what's interesting. By the way, I was brought up Catholic. It reminds me of what happened with the John the 23rd and the Second Ecumenical Council. And suddenly there was folk singing in masses. The priest turned around and faced the congregation instead of having his back to them all along. It does seem that some of this same energy was happening everywhere at that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've got a sort of a sense of who he is. Let's move on to your experiences in the book again. And one thing I want to establish right now, I noticed that at one point late in the book, Rabbi Zalman sort of ritualistically rehearses death, but he's still alive, isn't he? And how is his health at this time? Because you finished the interviews, a year ago or something?
Yes. That was very interesting. He's always done radical things, and this may have been one of the most radical. There's a Jewish ritual when somebody dies where you wash the body, you pay respect to this body that has carried this soul for this time, and it's done ritualistically by a certain group of people who do this, who volunteer to do it, and it's called a tahara, and it's very sacred and very special, and he decided he wanted to have a tahara while he was alive.
Uh-huh.
And when he asked a fellow rabbi to do it, to lead it, the rabbi was horrified. He said, I couldn't imagine doing this to a living person. And then he realized, because he loves Reb Zalman, and even though he's a conservative rabbi in a conservative congregation, he says he has renewal tendencies. And he introduces some of the practices that, that Reb Zalman initiated back in the day into his conservative congregation. So he said, I realize that Reb Zalman's life and work has been all about embodying deep wisdom, not just hearing it, reading it, memorizing it, but embodying it. And Reb Zalman wanted to do it because he feels that that something of him will continue after his body dies, and that he may be watching this being done to his corpse, and he wanted to see what it would be like so when it happened it would be familiar. So on an appointed day, he went to meet with three or four men, and they were all had white sashes on, and they looked very solemn, and they carried him down to a place. He wanted to do it by a running river water, so it was by a little rivulet. And they set up the table, and he took off his clothes. He took out his dentures, out his lenses for his contact lenses, so that he was completely naked, and he was under a sheet. And they started reciting the Song of Songs, where they're praising. You know, his thighs are like marble. He's like a giant. His body like a sequoia, when in fact his thighs ain't like marble anymore. And he's certainly not looking like a sequoia, but they pour water over him in warm water in a ritualistic way. And he said the whole time he was not thinking, oy, 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 I'm dying. He was thinking, yes, this is how it's going to be. This is what will happen. This is okay. And when they finished and they took off the sheet, they raised the sheet from over his head, he immediately started reciting the prayer that observant Jews recite every morning when they get up, thanking God for giving them another day of life and restoring the soul to their body. And one of the men who took part in it said you could see his love for the world, for this life, at this very moment that he was rehearsing to leave it.
And to my question, which was, and is he still alive, and what is his health like at this time?
He's alive. He will be 90 in August. His health is increasingly fragile, mm-hmm. but he will be, if you can get yourself to Temple Emmanuel on April 9, he's going to be present via Skype.
Oh, interesting.
A rare opportunity to see him, perhaps for the only and last time. So I would urge people to do everything they can to try to get to Temple Emmanuel.
In Beverly Hills, 7:30, April 9th, and as we said, more information available on Sarah's website, sarahdavidson.com, S-A-R-A, Davidson.com. Again, Sarah will be in town April 7th at USC, April 9th at Temple Emmanuel. More information on her website, sarahdavidson.com. Okay, let me ask you, first of all, what do you think was in it for Rabbi Reb Zalman in this series of interviews with you, and then I'm going to talk about your experience.
Well, he said that it's funny. He's 89, and he knows more about technology than I do. His office has just got wires running every which way. There are big screens. There are everything. He loves technology, and he said he wanted his wisdom to be uploaded and saved.
Yeah.
And he said when he was a young man, none of his teachers, none of his rebbes, talked to him about the end of life, which is quite astonishing because everybody has to die. It was never in the curriculum for rabbis' learning and training. It's a big unknown. And Judaism, unlike some other faiths, doesn't say much about the afterlife.
Yeah, I was going to say, I recall reading a satirical piece a few years ago in which one of the big selling points for the apostles in spreading Christianity was this promise of heaven.
Yes.
And they're working there among the Jews, and the Jews go, my God, it sounds like a great deal. What is the conventional Jewish teaching regarding the afterlife?
It's very empty. It's basically the most contemporary Jews kind of feel that when it's over, and you live on in the memories of other people and from the good works you did. However, the traditional view of Judaism, which doesn't mean it's about in the land, is that there are two worlds, this world and the world to come. But the world to come, the way Reb Zalman described it, is it's the world without furniture, without furniture. There's no description of it. But yet there is a constant in every prayer, they say, in this world and the world to come. So the idea was that the soul enters the body on birth, and when the body dies, the soul goes to the next world. But nobody talks about what that world is. However, the mystical tradition in Judaism, which is called Kabbalah, does have writings about what that world is going to be like, but they've never been translated into English.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So for him, it was to fill sort of that gap that he'd found when he was trying to learn. And it is interesting when you think about it. You think, why do people come to religion? And it would seem to me, you know, to deal with the mystery of death would seem to be one of the main reasons. So the fact that they don't is quite a big deal. Now, he said to you, he said, I don't want to convince you of anything. What I want to do is loosen your mind. And did your mind loosen, and if so, how?
Yes. It wasn't my mind that did it, by the way.
Uh-huh.
I have to, you know, tell you, there's a wonderful quote by Nabokov in his memoir where he said, common sense tells us that our existence is just a streak of light between two eternities of darkness. And the cradle rocks over this abyss, and people are more comfortable. They don't think that much about the darkness and the abyss that existed before they came here, but they are very concerned with the abyss they're heading toward. So that was where I was at when we started. Despite years of meditation and workshops and spiritual this and that, I still had a fear that it would all end in nothing, and a terror because no description of the afterlife ever rang true to me.
By the way, let me come from the way I personally heard what you just said. It seems to me that those are two different things. One is your sense that that if you did continue, it was some sort of formlessness to which you couldn't relate. But second, that you feared that. In other words, it seems to me it is possible to hold that first belief and not fear it. What changed for you, the belief or the fear?
No, I didn't believe that. I thought it was, you know, I didn't believe any of the descriptions, merging with the infinite. I didn't
continue
in some way.
So the switch just went off. The lights are on, the lights are off.
That was my terror.
Okay.
My fear.
Got it.
And you know, Terrence, have you had those moments? You know, most of the time we repress the knowledge that we're going to die, but every once in a while, and I know you recently had a life-threatening illness, but even without that, every once in a while you get it in your bones, my God, I'm going to cease to exist. And when that happened to me, I was filled with dread. So that's how I came to Reb Zalman, not able to believe any picture or description of an afterlife, hoping there might be one, but not having any conviction. And what happened was I heard his descriptions of the afterlife, which I couldn't relate to either. He had many descriptions of them at various times. What happened was I got sick. I got an episode of vertigo, which sounds like nothing, but I was dizzy, so intensely dizzy, I couldn't walk, I couldn't sit up, I could hardly keep my eyes open, and it went on and on. And no doctor could help me with it, and I finally went to an alternative healer, and I was lying on his table, and he was feeling my pulses and the energy in my body, and all of a sudden I heard, as one sometimes hears from within, it's all right to die. It's not something terrible. It's not something fearsome. When it happens and it's not imminent, it will be all right. And it filled me with a kind of warmth, and I had these memories that came to me of other people who had said similar things. And, you know, it's one thing to hear somebody say it, but it's another thing to hear it from within. And I had this feeling it was almost going to be like if I was on a sleigh ride in the snow, in the cold, with fur rugs over me, driving, being driven towards some faraway lights that meant civilization and hospitality. that's what it felt like to me, that dying was going to be like. It was just an image that came to me and a feeling. It wasn't in the mind, which is what I've been trying to say.
Yeah, and even that description you give of the sleigh, the sort of this gentle progress towards something, that wasn't in your mind either, right?
No.
Yeah, it was just a sense.
Just a sense and a feeling and a picture that came to me.
Okay, has that sense stayed with you?
That's the first question I asked the healer. I said, I told him what happened, and I said, you know, is this going to disintegrate like a lots of visions and experience, and I'll go right back to my fear? And he said, are you asking if it has a shelf life? I said, yeah, I am. And he says, well, we'll see. Well, I can tell you that was 3 years ago, and I can still access it. If I close my eyes and get quiet, I can still access that feeling, and I have noticed. I think if I got a diagnosis of a fatal disease, that I would feel terror and shock, and then I would come to feeling I can let go, because that's what it is, really. It's letting go. It's letting go of life, and it's letting go of the people you love. Even, you know, at that moment, you're going to have to leave them. It's letting go of the places you've been. Everything you've loved in life, you're going to let go of. And one of the practices, I want to say that at the end of the December Project, the book that I wrote after this time with Reb Zalman, there are 12 exercises. So if you want to take up the December Project, which I highly recommend, it can benefit anybody at any age, even children, because they're all things you want to do at any age, develop gratitude and learn the art of letting go. And you start with small things like, somebody just canceled lunch I was really looking forward to. Darn, I'm disappointed. Can you let go of that? And then you go to bigger things. I didn't like that conversation and I feel angry. Can I let go of the anger? And you just keep working on it. It's not one thing you do once. Okay, I'm going to let go now. And then you're done. It's a moment by moment, year by year practice of letting go. And if you practice it enough and have this some kind of intuition or intimation that even if you don't have that sense that dying will be all right, if you don't know, most of us, I think everybody, nobody knows, nobody's ever come back and described it perfectly, even if you don't know, you can practice letting go, and I've found that I can imagine the final letting go, which is what Reb Zalman teaches. And I want to say also that even though the book hasn't been published yet, you can pre-order it. Again, go to sarahdavidson.com. And if you pre-order it, you will get a free bonus MP3, a 20-minute recording that I made with Reb Zalman. It's extra material, not in the book. He sings, we talk, and then at the end, he leads a meditation, a guided meditation about letting go. And every time I listen to it, I just do it.
Okay, very good. So if you pre-order the book from your website, you get that MP3. Yeah, I was going to ask about the exercises. You, as you say, the end of this book, The December Project, has 12, right? And giving thanks, making friends with solitude, meditating between contractions, disidentifying with the body, etc. Two that are interesting are the social review and the philosophical review of your life. Talk about that just a bit. That's Sarah Davidson. We're talking about the December Project.
Well, Reb Zalman advocates that everybody do a life review. And usually it's best if you do it with somebody, because I was horrified at the idea that I didn't want to review all the mistakes I'd made.
Right.
I'd done wrong and the ways I'd screwed up. And I just couldn't bear the idea of reviewing all that. And he said, do it with a friend who loves you and you feel secure with. And when those kind of things come up, you look and ask, first of all, when I screwed up that way and blew it, where were you coming from at that time? What did you know? What were you able to do? Why did you do it that way? And then how would you do it differently with what you know now? And have you resolved not to do it again? And if so, what pearl did you get from that, you know, that dirty oyster? you got something from it, and you learned something. And that, so that's the way you review your life. And he says there are two reviews. First, you do the social review, which starts with the family you were born into, your mother, your father, your siblings, your relatives. And then you go decade by decade, who were the most important people I was with? And how do I feel about those people now? And am I still in touch with them? And if not, is there anything unfinished that I would like to communicate with them? And you go decade by decade. And that's a beautiful process. And if any forgiving needs to happen, if you need to forgive them or need them to forgive you, that's how you do it. You don't need to have the person sitting with you that you need to forgive or to forgive you. You can do it, and I describe how. All it takes is you letting go.
And you also mentioned, by the way, in the forgiveness portion, that there's three lists in forgiveness. The people you've harmed, who you would want to be forgiven for the harm you've done, the people who've harmed you, and the incidents where you need to forgive yourself.
Yeah, and that's the hardest one for me.
Yeah. Now these exercises, they come out of a book that's about death. They come about the December Project and how to sort of make peace with the inevitability of death or the imminence of death. But it struck me as I looked at them that they're fine practices.
Yes, for any.
Yeah, in other words, that's where I'm getting to, is for any time in your life. But do you think that there's some extra value or resonance in them, in that you're not merely doing them about today, but there's a kind of a thread that ties to life and death?
Yes, I don't consider this a book about death and dying. I consider it a book about living and dying, living and preparing for the transition, because that's really the whole point, is in doing these exercises, in reflection, in reading the book. It's full of laughter and songs and joy and love, and it's about letting go of the stuff that hurts us and hurts other people and bringing the other more into ascendance in every moment, every day. So it's not a depressing book.
No, not in any way. But what I really see, I wasn't expecting the exercises, and when I got to them, I said, well, wait a minute, this makes sense. You know, this makes sense in January or March.
I would always say that to Reb Zalman. One of the things about him that I discovered is he never gives you a straight answer. I would ask him, most importantly, what is the December work? What are you supposed to do in the December Project? And he never answered it. He'd tell me a story. He'd sing a song. He'd describe memories. You know, I could never get him to answer the question. And when I finally did, and he started explaining some of these techniques and practices, I said, but I want to do that now. It's a thing I'd want to do at any age. And he said, Sarala, that's what he called me.
Yeah.
Sarala, you could say that about everything I'm suggesting. You could suggest it's even appropriate for a baby in the cradle.
Very good. So even in January, or as I said, in March. But
as you said, he said the point is, this is what's most important for me right now and has extra resonance because I am 89.
Yeah. No, but I'm thinking that somehow the fact that it is linked to the ultimate ending, the ultimate moment, kind of, I think would give a deeper resonance perhaps to the fact that even though you're doing it at 25 or 35 or 45 and so on. We've got about 6 minutes. I want you to share just a little bit about any of your personal experiences with the deaths you've contended with in the recent years or the birth of your grandchild, any of that that has a certain resonance for you with all that we've been talking about.
There are so many, but I'm going to pick one. My biggest fear about the way I might die is having Alzheimer's. My mother died of it. Both her parents had dementia. They say there's a genetic component. Every time I forget a word or why I walked into a room, I would have a mini panic. It's starting. I'm starting, and I'm going to become, somebody who doesn't remember their name or, you know, people around them. And so I talked a lot about him with this fear, and one of my questions was, what happens to the soul? What happens to consciousness if your mind is gone to the point and your memory is gone to the point where you don't know your name? where is consciousness? Has it left the body? What's happened?
Well, you even say, what you also say is that as your mother is remembering less and less, she becomes more and more pleasant, and your relationship with her improves.
Yes, and also she was happy all the time, which she never was during her life. She became something they called pleasantly demented.
Which looks a lot like enlightenment.
It does, because she lived only in the moment, didn't remember the previous moment, and she was happy with everything. And I thought, after witnessing that, I thought, that looks a lot more pleasant way to go out than to be, you know, riding in pain with some terrible physical disease. But yet, if you ask people, most of them say they fear losing their mind more than having a physical illness. And what Reb Zalman said to me was, no matter what, they still have a sense inside of I am. There is still a presence there, and you can reach it. You can touch it by touching the person, by expressing love. They will feel it because there's still a presence of love in them. And I did experience that with my mother. When I said, I love you, Mom, or took her hand, she just beamed, and you could feel that it meant something to her. And then I said to him, well, so what do I do instead of panicking when I can't find my keys and they turn up in the freezer? And he said, instead of punishing yourself for forgetting and what's happening to my memory, go to that place inside where you can say, I am here. That presence is still here. Your keys are somewhere. They'll be found or they won't be, but you are here. And that was very comforting to me, and I try to implement it, but don't always succeed.
And it's even one of the 12 exercises.
Yes.
Because as we know, statistically, we know a great deal of us, if we live long enough, will contend with our own dementia.
And if we have time left, I want to talk about the birth of my first grandson.
Yes, do that. We've got you got 3 minutes.
Yeah, my daughter recently had a baby boy, and she asked me. She lives in Chicago, and I live in Boulder, Colorado. And she asked me to organize the bris, which is the ritual circumcision that occurs 8 days after the boy is born. And I thought, how am I going to do that long distance? Well, I went online, and it turns out you can find moils. The person who does the ritual circumcision online, they're even rated on Yelp. So I found a moil. I took the plane there. We organized everything. And then she put the baby in my arms. And, you know, nobody can explain this. You hear people talk about how incredible it is to be a grandparent, but it's so beyond that. What I felt was, here is this tiny, tiny thing that's got this tiny new light shining from it, but it's so small. And when I put it against my chest, I could feel its heart beating against mine. And I felt this connection. Here's this tiny new light coming in while my light is gradually fading. It's fading to dark, but this new light is coming in. And through me, this baby is connected to the past, and through this baby, I'm connected to the future. And it was just one of those moments when you just get to be. There's no thought. There's nothing except this communion with the light.
Interesting. And for you, that was qualitatively different from had you held a newborn that was not your daughter's son?
Exactly. I mean, I still would have loved it. But this was the most amazing thing. She gave him the middle name Marvin, which was my father's name. And my daughter and I have had a prickly, would be put it mildly, relationship. And the fact that she named her baby after my father was so overwhelming to me that yes, there is a difference. And I would like to be able to love all babies the way I love my grandchildren, because they deserve it, and I would like to cultivate that. But it is special.
Yeah. The thing I'm going to end with is two or three, four times we come to a point where you're describing something and in the midst of your description say, this is not in the mind. This is, and so if it's not in the mind, I'm here to tell you it is not in words. It is not in language. And I realize that one of the great challenges of everything we've been talking about is that we're talking about essential experiences, and yet we have to write about them. We have to talk about them, or they remain ineffable and only with us. A challenge for a writer or a radio host.
Oh, yes, but it's a worthy thing to do, because yeah. It makes it more real when you can fit words, even if they're not fully satisfactory.
So again, the book is The December Project, An Extraordinary Rabbi and a Skeptical Seeker Take Aim at Our Greatest Mystery. You can learn more at sarahdavidson.com. That's S-A-R-A, no H, S-A-R-A-D-A-V-D-A-V-I-D-S-O-N.com. Sarah has a couple of appearances coming up in L.A. in early April to talk about the new book. Monday, April 7th, she'll be at USC at 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 9th, she'll be at Temple Emmanuel in Beverly Hills at 7:30. And in that one, there will be a Skype appearance by Reb Zalman. You can get more information on both of those at her website, sarahdavidson.com. Thank you, Sarah. Keep
Karen,
up the good work.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to talk with you at any time, but especially live on the radio.
Okay. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at T.E. McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi, and Mark Maxwell in production. To you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week, which will be my last show before I take a hiatus. And I don't plan to have a guest. It'll just be you and me next week for an hour.